Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Autumn is upon us. The Earth's 23.5 degree tilt on its axis phases into another season as summer fades into memory. It's also incredibly precise when you consider the scale of it. I can't even find a toaster oven that gets both sides of the bread right, yet this spinning sphere somehow manages to follow just the right orbit over eons of time to regulate four distinct seasons. It's pretty damn amazing. Everything goes in circles, doesn't it? We spend our lives on a carousel of sorts. Weeks and months and seasons, holidays, World Series, Super Bowls, seamless repetition. Whoever invented that brass ring thing, which, by the way, I've only seen on one carousel in my life, that brass ring is kind of symbolic and necessary. If in the course of completing the whole revolution around the sun, we don't come away with some kind of reward, some acknowledgement that we were at least able to hang on, to not be thrown by the carousel horse that is life, what's the point? Are those horses assigned to us at birth? Maybe. For some, life can be tame and steady. For others, it's a wild ride. Some people switch horses in mid-ride. Is it deliberate, or is it karma? There was a museum right near my office in Manhattan, and they once had this exhibition of carousel horses. I never thought much about them when I rode them as a kid. Just wanted to be sure to hop on one that went up and down as the ride moved. The stationary ones were a bore. And who the hell ever wanted to sit in one of those swans or chariots? Although those might represent a make-out opportunity if you were with your girlfriend, have to be sure you were on the outside so centrifugal force would ensure she'd be pressed against you for the ride. So at this museum, I learned that there are two distinct styles of carousel horses, the Philadelphia and the Coney Island styles. The Philadelphia style is the one I prefer. Some of those steeds look as if they could be mounts for the horsemen of the apocalypse. Their heads are thrown back, their manes are whipping in the wind, they look wild and enraged, lots of teeth showing. The Coney Islands look like My Little Pony, tame and lame. Which you would not expect from Coney Island. It was a wild place in Brooklyn. Mean streets, freak shows, beer halls, and eat-till-you-puke contests. I dig old amusement parks, not Disneyland. That place is too damned antiseptic and corporate. It has no soul. In fact, I demolished Disneyland way back in episode 9. Larry Destroys Disneyland. That was in the February 2017 archive at thatlarryshow.com. No, the kind of old amusement parks I dig are like Coney Island or Rye Playland or Asbury Park and Seaside Heights on the Jersey Shore. Places like that with grit and character. Probably aren't too many left that go back a long way. Coney Island was maybe the grittiest with the famed Cyclone roller coaster. There was a time I got on a roller coaster kick, sampled as many as I could over the tri-state area. I was in college at the time, working at a Mahbone bar, which I've mentioned in episodes 57 and 45, and the cook there, Scotty, who was a fantastic stand-up dude, he told me about the cyclone at Coney Island. Now, being a short-order cook, Scotty was not well off, but he told me with complete honesty that there was no amount of money he would accept to ride that roller coaster again. He said it was that brutal. Well, of course, that's all I needed to hear. Within a week or two, I was at Coney Island, which I'd only visited once before as a small kid with my dad. On that first visit, when I was maybe 6 or 7, we ate some Nathan's hot dogs, rode some of the tamer rides. I asked Dad to take me on the Cyclone, but that was out of the question. Turns out, Dad knew some things. We saw a guy on the sidewalk with this tremendous brass telescope on a tripod. It looked like something out of Jules Verne. Must have been 8 feet long with a 10 or 12 inch diameter. There was a perfect harvest moon that night, just beautiful. And that's what the scope was pointed at. And for a buck, he'd let you look through it at the moon. So Dad paid him and I put my eye to the finder and for a second I thought it was gimmicked. That he had stuck a NASA photographic slide in there and backlit it. I didn't just see craters. I saw zits. And then the guy moved the damn telescope and I yelled, "Hey, stop moving this thing." And the guy laughs and tells me the only thing moving is the Earth we're standing on. Well, no amount of classroom or book study or even a video could have been as convincing as looking through that antique but very powerful telescope, convinced that we are indeed on a ride. It was something of an epiphany. I got an inkling about this carousel of life. So many years later, after the telescope realization, I drove down to Coney with a pal. It was an autumn evening then. Before I got to the Cyclone, there were go-karts to ride. Nothing special or tricky, just a small oval track. Maybe half a dozen carts buzzing around. I hopped on one and away I went and suddenly, bam, I'm out of the go-kart and sprawled on the pavement. Some asshole had T-boned me. I don't even know how it could have happened. He was just some head case who thought it would be funny. When I picked myself up off the track, I was surprised to find I was in one piece and not bleeding. The operator told me the guy who hit me ran away. Do you believe in omens? As I walked toward the Cyclone, Scotty's warning was echoing around in my head, a head that could have easily been dented or cracked from my last thrill. But I wasn't going home without a ride on the famed Cyclone, so on I went. Everybody said this was the one to beat. It had been built in 1927, that's pretty damn old, even though it's supposedly been reconstructed a couple of times since. But it still had 1927 technology and safety, namely a skimpy metal bar that came down across your lap. That was it. No belts, no harnesses, and no padding on that bar. For a long time, the Cyclone had the steepest vertical drop of any coaster in the world. And as that car clacked up the hill, I could really feel the chill breeze off the Atlantic. And as it crested the summit, it began to slow, almost paused at the peak. Which is also a lot like some of the more critical moments in life. You come to a fork in the road, or a line to cross, or a fence to hop. A decision must be made. Left or right, over or under, advance or retreat. And that decision is irrevocable, the point of no return. And just as with this coaster, there is one option not on the table. Indecision. No standing still, no delay, no exit. Make a choice or one will be made for you. When we look back, we sometimes realize the decision was made long before we encountered the crossroads or chasm. Mine was made when that iron bar snapped down over my knees. Not maybe, maybe it was made back in that saloon when Scotty told me what a lousy decision this would be. Overhead, that same harvest moon I'd looked at through that telescope was hanging like a prop on a movie set. It was too perfect. And then the descent began. It was like a free fall. The iron bar across my knees felt thin and insignificant. People screamed. All I could hear was Scotty's voice in my head. But that vertical drop wasn't what separated it from other coasters. It was the violence of the ride. The turns and jolts on it were much, much worse than the broadside I'd endured on the go-kart earlier that evening. It felt like the thing was going to kill me. When it finally came to rest, the only thrill I felt was to still be alive and walking away from it. I never looked back. I had zero desire to ever board that ride again. When I came home that night, I flicked on the late news. There was a shot of the Coney Island Cyclone, bathed in the garish lights of ambulances. A few rides after mine, some skinny kid was in the last car, which I suppose has a whip effect. And he was so slim, he just slipped right out of the car and plummeted on the sidewalk a great distance below. A true free fall. The reporter said he was in grave condition. They don't say grave anymore, now they say critical. Grave was just too honest, I suppose. Over the years, more people told me of their cyclone adventures that turned to nightmares. My own Uncle John had taken a girlfriend on a cyclone, and the damn thing snapped her head so hard, she lost many of her teeth on that lap bar. I checked Wikipedia, which lists only 3 deaths attributed to it, but that's just since 1985. As if, what, in the first 58 years that ride was so much safer, and people only started dying on it in the 80s? Nonsense. That thing has killed plenty more. It's sinister. Amazing they even get insurance. I've always dug autumn the most of the seasons, and I can't give an exact reason. Why do you like a certain song, or a color, or a kind of music, or a flavor of ice cream? You just do. And when I really ponder my preference for autumn, it should not pencil out. Autumn meant back to school. And for the most part, I did not dig school. It was a gloomy place. How gloomy? Go to thatlarryshow.com to the January 2017 tab and listen to episode 5, Larry Slugs a Nun. You will get a taste for just how depressing and violent my grammar school was. But then autumn had some other cool stuff. The World Series, yeah, once upon a time I was a baseball fan. It had Halloween, Thanksgiving, all good times. And my old man, who really was a fabulous dad, he knew how shitty school could be, so I think he tried to take the sting off it by cooking up some good weekend diversions. He was from the Bronx, and he knew a lot of its secrets, and one of its best was Pelham Bay Park. Now, when people think New York City parks, they generally think Central Park. But Pelham Bay Park really kicks its ass. It's many times larger and actually has some fairly deep woods and a beach and a rocky shore. It can be beautiful any time but summer when it's crawling with people. So many a fall or even winter Saturday, the old man would pack me and my brother into the Chevy and head north. First, we'd stop at a supermarket, grab some Nathan's Famous hot dogs, which are the best, some buns, and a few potatoes. All that stuff would go in an old surplus rucksack he had, along with some matches, a hatchet, a canteen full of water. We were going camping, finger quotes. Now, I've tried real camping, you know, tents and mosquitoes and sleepless nights and crapping in the bushes. Even done some glamping in a Luxo RV. No thanks to that, too. I'll take Dad's version of camping, a few hours outdoors, a bonfire, some food Mom does not approve of, and a healthy dose of adventure. Now, this park had a huge, huge parking lot, which was invariably deserted in the off-season. So before we'd hike into the woods, The old man would say to me and my brother, "Hey, who wants to drive?" And I was like 7 or 8. And my brother was 3 years older, and Dad would let us hop behind the wheel and tool around that asphalt for a while. Lefts, rights, figure eights. He'd have us signal turns, pretend to parallel park. It wasn't just a lark, it was a driving lesson. What a kick! By the time I was old enough to drive legally, I needed no lessons. I'd already logged many miles in that vast parking lot. One time a cop car cruised into the lot with me at the wheel of Dad's Chevy. The cop immediately surmised that Dad was giving his kids a charge. The cop squawked the siren and hit the roof lights for a second, and then he laughed and waved. He probably took his kids there to fool around too. What a better time that was to be alive and a kid. Can you imagine that scene happening today? No way. There would be fines and maybe an arrest and lawyers and court dates and a suspended license for Dad. Maybe some child protective services involvement. Endangering two minors. Oh, the danger. So dangerous. How did we get from a society where intelligent people used their good judgment to this rigid, rule-obsessed, goose-stepping world of stiff-necked, tight-assed, humorless, by-the-book procedurists and automatons utterly devoid of humanity? We'd usually hike in far enough to the shore, which was all craggy rocks. No swimming was possible there. Then the old man would cut us loose to forage for firewood. There was always plenty of dried brush and branches, but if you have a hatchet, you have to use it, don't you? And so I did. I decided to hack away at some hunk of wood, missed a mighty swing, and laid that hatchet into my own shin. Oh, the pain. I rolled up my jeans to have a look, and probably I wasn't bleeding. But that bone bruise lingered for weeks. I never told my father or my brother why I limped the rest of the day. How could I cop to such stupidity? Pretty soon we had a nice pile of kindling and thicker wood to feed the fire. Dad lit it up, and we wrapped the spuds in aluminum foil. Next, we whittled the ends of sticks to impale the hot dogs. Nothing tastes as good as a dog cooked over a bonfire. Nothing. The potatoes took a while longer. No sour cream, no butter, no utensils either. We ate them like bananas. And they were great, too. Dessert was, of course, toasted marshmallows. With our bellies full, it was time to break out the slingshots. As bucolic as the setting was, it was still within the confines of New York City, where littering was once an art form. In no time flat, we gathered armfuls of discarded Pepsi bottles and quart bottles of Colt 45 and so on, all of which made fantastic targets. Down to the water's edge, we'd hurl them far out into the drink and shoot at them. No BBs, no buckshot. We used pebbles, and they worked great. It's amazingly satisfying to acquire the target and destroy it with a weapon of biblical vintage. Every one of those bottles was a Goliath to me. Man, it was great. Soon that afternoon, autumnal light was weakening, and the old man suggested a swing through the woods on the way back to the car. We'd been over that course many times, but always found something new to marvel at. A tree with a tumor the size of a Volkswagen, or lover's initials carved into a tree trunk circa World War II. Over the decades, the growth of the trunk would distort the letters into fantastic shapes, but you could still make them out. Brenda and Joey, Maria, and Ed. Always encircled by a heart, sometimes followed by the number 4 and the word ever. We'd read them and wonder about them and make up stories. Maybe Ed caught Maria with Joey and he buried them right where we stood. Or maybe Brenda got sick of Joey and became a nun. Stuff like that. On this particular afternoon, we spotted something we'd never noticed before. A couple of rusting 55-gallon oil drums, side by side. For the hell of it, my brother and I rolled them away, and to our utter amazement, they covered an opening in the ground about the size of a manhole. When we looked down into it, it was a chamber, size of a jail cell, and it was clear someone was living there. There was a mattress down there, some ratty bedding, a radio, a lantern, water jugs, stuff like that. What we could not figure out was how anyone got in and out of it. It was a direct drop, 5 or 6 feet, and there was no ladder. We also could not figure out what had become of the dirt somebody had to displace to hollow the room out. Had to have been one guy with a shovel. Hell of a job. Then my father said, "Let's go now." We rolled the drums back over the hole. Speculation about that cavern fueled our conversation for weeks. I'd seen hobos in rail yards and the drunkards on Delancey Street in Manhattan, but this scene was unsettling. As we trudged back to the car, a nice, warm, meticulously maintained Chevy, headed for our small but cozy house in Queens, I thought about the squalor of that guy's dwelling. Not even a cave, a literal hole in the ground. What was it like to sleep in that cold and damp? How good were those rotted oil drums at keeping out the rain and sleet? Never mind the rats, insects, and other vermin. Now I wonder if he ever rolled back those drums on a clear night and looked up at the moon. Did he notice how soon that orb would vanish as this ride we are on, this amazing, fantastic carousel, goes round and round? What horse was he given at birth? A Philadelphia Hellion or a Coney Island Dray? Whichever the case, it was clear he had been thrown, and he hadn't gotten back on. We all get one ride, some of us for a long time, some for just a few spins. Some grab brass rings and some are natural alchemists, turn that brass into gold. For some it's a thrill ride, for others, a chore. It's all attitude, I suppose. But it's great to have taken this little ride with you. Thanks for hanging with me. For more content and commentary, go to the show page at thatlarryshow.com. Click a subscribe button so you never miss an episode. And if you'd like to support the show, click the Patreon button and enter the inner circle with dozens of bonus episodes, signed books, custom recordings, and more. Come back and hang with us this weekend for Sinner Sunday, where we all kick back with a cold beer, hot barbecue, and knock around things of a spiritual nature. See you soon.